from the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
If I had a theme to my life, or at least one for Sunday mornings, that would be it. Can only mean one thing. Gordon Goldsborough joins me now in studio from the Manitoba Historical Society. Good morning.
Good morning, Nadja.
How are you doing this weekend?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. Now, remind us of the clue from last week.
Well, I said we would visit a remarkable site northwest of Dauphin that is considered by heritage advocates to be among the most complete and the best preserved pioneer homestead in certainly all of Canada and possibly even all of North America.
That's quite a title.
Well, maybe I should just tell our listeners that one of the things that about me is that I'm really a big fan of science fiction.
Okay.
And especially science fiction that involves time machines. I just love this notion that you could transport back into the past.
Right.
And it walk around and look at things in the past. And, you know, of course, we don't think at least that these things do exist. But I would say that the site we're going to look at today is the closest experience you're going to get to time traveling back to 1899 here in Manitoba. Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a wonderful site. What I'm referring to is the homestead of a fellow named Vasil Negrich. He and his wife, Anna, and their kids homesteaded here back in the area. It's about 24 miles by road northwest of Dauphin, about 12 miles northeast of Gilbert Plains. So that's sort of the area north of Riding Mountain National Park. They settled here. They came here from the part of Ukraine, sort of the western part of Ukraine, in 1897. They came across the ocean, of course, in a large boat. They landed at Quebec City. They took a train across Canada, arrived in Winnipeg, traveled across the prairies to this area. They stopped at Dauphin for a while until they kind of found where they were going to settle. And then Vasil Negrich and three of his brothers, he came with a large extended family, they each took up what's called a quarter section.
Okay.
Basically, the land is divided up into 1 square mile, and then it's subdivided into four chunks, four quarter sections. And each farmer was eligible for one of these quarter sections. So Vasil took one of them, and then his three brothers took the other three. So basically, they had sort of a little Negrich family enclave there in this square mile. And what's interesting about that, and what's, I think, significant to our story, is that instead of doing what many of the settlers did, which was locate right next to the edge of the what they called the road allowance, where the road would eventually be built, that would mean your farm would be close to a road so you could get out and go to the outside world. No, instead, the Negriches moved to the inside corner of their land so that the four of them were then close to each other. It made it sort of a little sort of a settlement, almost like they would have had perhaps back in the Ukraine. And what that means, of course, is they're kind of remote. They're off the road, so to speak. And so there they built – well, so listeners may recall that some time ago we talked about something called a Buddha. A Buddha is a temporary shelter that was built by many of these arriving Ukrainian settlers, sort of an A-frame-shaped structure made out of some poplar poles covered in either straw or cowhide or something. And so the Negriches, Annie and Vasil, along with their seven children, they came with seven kids.
They're really repopulating that little
compound. They indeed were. And they moved into these Buddhas. And they lived there for up to 2 years until they had built themselves a home. So in 1899, they had this house. Now, the house was only about 500 square feet.
Wow.
Well, by our standards today, like my house is, what, about 1,600 square feet? And I only have four of us in our house compared to having, you know, nine of them in this little house.
Cozy.
Cozy, very so much so. The building itself was made out of squared tamarack logs that were notched at the ends. They covered the logs with sort of a mud plaster that they made out of mud combined with straw, with some cow dung and water, and then slathered on both sides. And to make it white, they added something called laundry bluing to the mixture.
Okay.
And that made it really nice and white. They plastered this on both sides of the logs, on the outside of the building, on the inside, making a smooth surface. They put a roof on top that they covered in wooden shingles. And then underneath the building, they had a root cellar. And so there they could store things like their potatoes, their onions, their carrots, you know, things that they would need over the winter to feed themselves. I'm told that the way this thing looks, this building is very similar to the houses that were built in the western Ukraine, sort of in the Carpathian Mountains area.
Okay.
You know, it is exactly the way that people lived 100 or more years ago. There was three rooms inside. There was a large central room, which would be sort of the family room, so to speak. They had probably a wood stove in there. table and so on. Mm-hmm. And then on either side, they would have a smaller room. One would be mom and dad's bedroom, and the other one would be the bedroom for the kids. Well, initially, it was probably all the kids, but then as the family started to grow, because although they came with seven, they had another five. When they arrived. So now they had 12 kids in this little 500 square foot house. So I think that proved to be a bit of a challenge to have room for them all. So shortly after they arrived, they began building other buildings alongside the house. So they built, for example, what they called the bunkhouse, which was for the boys. The boys went and lived out in the bunkhouse. The girls stayed with mom and dad in the house. They also had a cow barn. They had a pig pen. They had a chicken coop. They had granaries to store the grain. Because on the land that they had acquired, this 160 acres, they cut down the trees to make fields. They would grow grain, and then they'd store the grain that they had harvested in these granaries. They had a vegetable garden. They had a herb garden. They had an orchard. Apparently, they had something like six varieties of apples. They had plums. They had sour cherries. You know, they could be self-sufficient.
Yeah, I was going to say, totally self-sustainable.
Lived right off the grid entirely. In fact, there's the thing. They had no electricity. They had no indoor plumbing. They had no running water. In fact, the house is not far from the drifting river. It's just a small meandering river. And they would go down and with a bucket and just dip water out of the river. That was their source of drinking water and water for cooking. Even in the later years, you know, when telephones came in, when electricity came in, nope, none for them. Mm. So even as late as the 1980s, now, this is, of course, many years later. By that time, Mr. Negrich had passed away. He died back in 1927. His wife, Anna Negrich, she died in 1944. The kids, of these 12 kids, some of them, of course, moved away and started a life for themselves elsewhere. But several of them stayed on the original farm. A couple of them in particular stayed. And so even in the 1980s, here now, these children are now in their 70s and 80s, and they were living in a house that had no electricity. You know, they heated with a wood stove. They cooked on a wood stove. They had no running water. They had an outhouse for sanitation. You know, it was really life as people lived it 200-300 years ago.
That's incredible. Up until the 1980s, we don't even think about that.
No, you don't. I mean, you tend to think that over time settlers would modernize. They would perhaps build a more modern house with all the amenities. Yeah. But no, not these. They kept it exactly the way it had been when it was built in 1899. And see, there's the time travel element, it seems to me, because you can see then a building that would be very much like they would have built hundreds of years ago. Well, of course, ultimately, the last of the Negriches passed away in 1992. Stephen Negrich, one of the younger children who had been born in 1903, he actually had gone off and become a teacher. He had trained here in Winnipeg at Wesley College, which is, now the University of Winnipeg. He then spent 38 years teaching in various one-room schools. And then when he retired in 1968, he came back to the farm. So his sister, Annie, was living in the old family house by herself, and Stephen moved into back into the bunkhouse where he had lived as a little kid.
Full circle.
And the two of them lived in this site for really the rest of their lives. Eventually, as they got elderly, Annie had to move into Gilbert Plains into a senior's residence. Stephen later moved into Dauphin. So when Stephen passed away in mid-1992, he was literally the last of the Negriches to live there. And he was buried in a cemetery not far from the house, along with many of his extended families. Well, there we get into the abandonment part. Now we have this remarkable site that is essentially intact, you know, that is really a throwback to the life of many years ago. The discussion was, what do we do? And the local Lions Club stepped in and said, you know, we really should preserve this site. And at one point, the idea was they were going to move the buildings to something called Selo Ukraina, which is a museum site south of Dauphin. It's a nice site. It's got wonderful facilities, but it would have been a disaster to have moved these buildings there because, you know, frankly, it would have been no different than any other museum. Okay. You go to a lot of museums, they've got an obligatory pioneer homestead.
Right.
And, you know, you poke your head in, you look around and go, man, I'm glad I don't live like this.
Right.
But the fact is the context of the site that they're at is so much a part of it that you don't just get a sense of the house, you get a sense of the surroundings, you know, the garden, the orchard, which are still there. The fact that it's way off the road so that you really get a sense that, you know, you see none of the trappings of modern life when you go to this site. So fortunately, they saw that as a real virtue. And so when they finally decided on a plan, the plan was to maintain it exactly as it had been, so that it was really sort of a living, breathing sort of little time capsule, I suppose, of a bygone day. So it was restored through the 1990s. It opened to the public to visit in the 1994, as far near as I can tell. And what's more important, I think, is that it was recognized by government as being significant. So in 1992, the provincial government designated it as a provincial historic site. And in 1996, the national government designated it as a national historic site. And there aren't many national historic sites. So for this place to be designated a national historic site really says to me that it's noteworthy.
Yeah.
So it's open for visits. I would encourage anyone listening to go and check it out. It's really worthwhile. Mm-hmm. It's open during the summer months, July and August. I was there, though, in the preamble to that, I was there in June. And actually, that was kind of neat, too, because it wasn't occupied then. Mm-hmm. And I walked the long walk. It's a good half mile off the highway. You have to leave your car and then walk along the road because it's all, you know, closed up. But to me, that was kind of part of the experience. It literally felt like I was walking. Every step I took was another year back into the past. So when I got to the yard, it was like, wow, I am back in 1899. It was so cool.
That's so great. What about the orchards and stuff? If you went in June, can you kind of see that?
Well, you can certainly get a sense of it. Yeah, it was lush and green when I was there. Things, of course, hadn't grown fully,
right.
So you know, we wouldn't be able to see the fruits in the orchard. But you certainly get a sense of the site. And I would strongly encourage anyone who is interested in Ukrainian culture and the pioneer experience. It is very much worth a visit.
Very impressive. Thanks so much, Gordon.
You're welcome.
So give us the clue for next week.
Well, next year we're going to look at a river that was once the major shipping route for all supplies that were destined to northern Manitoba. But because of something that happened in the spring of 1893, that river has been abandoned ever since.
What happened in the spring of 1893? You will have to join us next week.
Stay tuned.
Thanks so much, Gordon.
You're welcome.
Every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba, many moons.